Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ sanghaṃ namassāmi. It's 13th of January, 2021. It's the Upasita, the one prat. And at the teaching at the end of the Padimokkha, first of all, Longpo Pasano chanted the Padimokkha. I hope I can be chanting the Padimokkha 31 years from now. In the same way, and then reminding us that it would be now the second day of the Longpo Cha Memorial, which was canceled due to the pandemic, and would be a week of practice at Wanong Papong. Usually it goes from something like January 12th to 17th. Usually there's practice and daily Dhamma talks, visiting Ajahn's. And we're in the winter retreat, and life of the Buddha is the theme. So Longpo Pasano and his Owada touched upon something that Longpo Cha, visiting the West, visiting England, and came back and was quite positive about his experience in the West, but then also there's a concern that it's an affluent society, and if there's no sense of going without, then there's not development in the practice. So we have to be careful. So being willing to go without sometimes, to experiment in that way, not to bring needless suffering upon ourselves, but to try sometimes to go without things that we think we need. For example, we're going without the computer use during the winter retreat, the monastic community. Or sometimes some people might be going without breakfast just to experiment in that way. This is what the Dutangas are for. That sense of going without. So even though we're in an affluent society, then we can still have that sense of going without. Of course, all of us here on the Eight Precepts go without dinner. Or when we are without things that we normally like, then separation from the liked is dukkha. So there's the likes and dislikes. And thinking of the life of the Buddha, and one hallmark of the Buddha is that he went against the stream of the world. He called into question the stream of the world. So he didn't just go with the stream, but he went against the stream. And that very much was the path of the samana, path of wisdom. Because the stream of the world is the stream of aging, sickness, and death, getting swept along by those things and intoxicated by those things. And getting bewildered by those things. So the Buddha, early in his life as a prince, he could have easily gone along with the world, which is personified by Mara, this character very central to the life of the Buddha, is Mara, the tempter, and Mara also means death, so or he's known as the end maker in the life of the Buddha. And so there's all sorts of conversations and interactions that the Buddha has with Mara throughout his life, and he usually concludes these conversations with, "I know you, end maker. I know you, Mara." And so Mara will come and he sees different, he can know what the Buddha's thinking at different times, and as this character that appears in the suttas, and he appears various times during the Bodhisatta, during his period of striving and practice. And the armies of Mara appear, and also he appears after the enlightenment, just trying to find a way and trying to seek some sort of way to either tempt the Buddha or see if he can get him off course. But of course, at that point, he's liberated, enlightened already, so it's irreversible. But we get these little teaching stories, and then you get the sense that Mara is a very central figure in the life of the Buddha. And Mara also appears to different bhikkhus and bhikkhunis at different times in the suttas. So we have in the Theragata and the Therigata. And also there's the, in the bhikkhu and bhikkhuni samyuttas, you get Mara, especially in the bhikkhuni samyutta, you get Mara appearing in almost every sutta. There's one sutta where the Buddha is in seclusion and a train of thought occurs to him. Would it be possible to rule as a Buddha, to rule over the whole world as a Buddha, rule righteously and rule by Dhamma as a world ruler and be a Buddha? And then he realizes, yeah, it actually would be possible. And then Mara, knowing that train of thought, appears to the Buddha and says, "Now is the time, Lord. Exercise leadership, exercise rulership over the earth. Now is the time." And the Buddha says something like, "This is, look, I was just thinking that this is not the way of Buddhas. I know you, Mara." But just that trying to get in there, and somehow that sutta is very poignant for me. But this sense of going against the stream, I think, is a very important image. So as a prince, or before his enlightenment, the Bodhisatta could have easily gone along with what his friends and family wanted for him and that sort of idea of, well, just enjoy life, and that's innocent enough. But he's looking to something deeper, which entails a going against the stream of what ordinary people will say is good and wonderful, and the finer things in life. Why not just do what everybody else is doing? Why not just surrender to the stream of the world and just enjoy? Why not? It's innocent enough. This is what everybody's doing. This is what everybody's saying. This is what everybody's thinking. Why not just go along with it? Just surrender to it. Just give into it. lose yourself to it. Why not just do that? But then there was something deeper on the spiritual level that the Buddha was looking at these things, and why go along with this? Why just blindly go along with this? Why not call it into question? So he started deeply questioning things, deeply questioning this idea of aging, sickness, death. Those three intoxications, the intoxication with health, the intoxication with youth, the intoxication with life itself. And so calling into question those intoxications. And so when we study the life of the Buddha, those things become apparent, and it's not those things, those teachings of the Buddha, they aren't there to make us feel bad or judged in any way. The Buddha's not saying you're bad for being intoxicated with health, you're bad for being intoxicated with youth, you're bad for being intoxicated with life, or you're bad for going along with the stream of the world. He's not saying that, but he's saying this is the cause of suffering. So when we study the life of the Buddha, the Four Noble Truths becomes a big part of it as well. Lungpo was saying in his talk the other night, that relating that Lungpo Samedo like to say, what do Buddhas know that ordinary people don't know? And they know that all things are impermanent and not self. Worded in another way, you could say, what do Buddhas know that ordinary people don't know? They know the Four Noble Truths. So the Four Noble Truths becomes a central part of the life of the Buddha, and you can't go through the life of the Buddha and not talk about the Four Noble Truths and not focus on each of those four truths, because that was the central focus of his teaching. So all of the Buddha's teachings, when the Buddha says something is bad, something is good, those aren't judgments, like if you do that, you're bad, or the Buddha didn't judge people in that way in terms of being character judgments, but he said something is bad if it's a cause of suffering, something is good if it leads to happiness and well-being, liberation. That's the Buddha's standard of judging things, is by the Four Noble Truths. Is it a cause of suffering or is it a cause of liberation? So when we study the life of the Buddha, then it becomes, of course, a study of the Four Noble Truths. And we can study it with different types of motivations, intentions, and we might begin with a sense of curiosity or intellectual interest, and that's good, that's fine. Then if we want to take it further, like think of my good friend Ajahn Pavaro, who is a professor of Buddhist studies in Canada, and eventually it's like, well, what's the logical conclusion to this? Well, practice. I've studied this, now all that's left is to practice. So then he became a monk, and a lot of people become monks. They might be like younger, like myself, but for Ajahn Pavaro, he had a family and was a father and ordained later on, became a very good monk. So that can happen as well. So we might come to with this sense of it's intellectually interesting. We were chanting the funeral chanting this evening, which is the Abhidhamma. So that's a very intellectually interesting teaching, going through the different mental factors and different ways that the mind can be seen, or these different facets of all sorts of mind moment mental factors. But then the Dhamma is open aiko, which is to be brought inward, to be internalized. So then the intellectual study of Dhamma is recommended. It's good. But then the conclusion to that is the practice. So then we bring it inward and we learn about the practice. So why would Lungpa Cha say that there's a bit of a danger if we don't ever go without, if it's too easy? Why would he say something like that? I think, like, the life of the Buddha, he really went without. He really got to know these different feelings that can arise through going without. So he knew the life of luxury, and then through the austerities and the asceticism, he knew what it was like to really go without. So what's hunger like? Do we really know what hunger is like? What's it like to go without happiness? And what's it like to go without comfort? It's not to say we torture ourselves, but just getting to know these things, that when we can't have them, what's it like? When we can't have the food we like, what's that like? When we can't have the special diet that we want, what's that like? Having special diets is a luxury that only occurs in affluent societies. We have the luxury to be able to choose a diet for ourselves. That's a sign of a luxurious society, a sign of affluence. So what's it like when we can't choose? What does that do to our minds? What's that like? So just, this is the way of the contemplative, the way of the samana, getting to know all of these states that can arise in the mind and the heart. And that's the open aiko dhamma, that's the bringing it inwards, applying it. What's it like when we don't feel happy or well? Do we sink? How far do we sink? Or is it possible still to be clear and mindful without that sense of feeling really well, feeling really happy? So going without even mental states that we think we need to feel. We might think, like, well, we can only practice if we feel well and happy and high and inspired. But what happens when we don't have those things? That's going without as well. I'm reading through the Ajahn Thun biography, which just came out in English. And he talks about that, his second Vasa. He was spending Vasa at a Wat Bapong branch monastery in Amper Namyun, as Lungpor Nudang. And there was a lot of work happening, and so he normally liked to, according to his character, he liked to meditate all the time. But also, as a junior monk, he would just go along with whatever was happening. And so there was a lot of work happening that Vasa in the monastery, and he didn't really have as much time to meditate as he would like. And he found that there was the happiness of samadhi that he was without, he started to suffer over that. But then he realized that with discernment, he would try to hold his mind with to not be dependent on the happiness of being able to meditate as much as he liked. And so he found he could get more into a mode of, well, when I have time to meditate, I'll meditate. But if I can't, or if I have to just be helping out with duties around the monastery, then I'll hold my mind in that with the attitude that that's okay too. And then by the end, he found that incredibly helpful, actually, developing that kind of discernment. It made it so that in any situation, he had a sense of solidity or a sense of firmness. So in a way, you could say the samadhi was deepened by that discernment. So learning how to hold the mind in a way that it doesn't falter too much or fall too far when it doesn't have the things that we normally are dependent on. It becomes more independent. And then that leads to the contemplation of what's the refuge? What are we taking refuge in? I remember having a little insight a while back that Dhamma practice, the mind was kind of getting agitated at one point in a couple years ago, and thinking, well, this insight just kind of came seemingly out of nowhere, that Dhamma isn't the Dhamma life, it isn't about getting something good. If it's about getting something good, that's the stream of the world. So a Dhamma life, it isn't about getting something good. That's not the way we hold the mind. It's just practice. It's just about practice. It's just about the moment. Perhaps we will get something good through that, but that's not the motivation, or that's not what it's about. Kind of hard to describe. It's like that, a word coming up for me today was analio, that sense of non-stickiness, or nothing attaches, nothing sticks to the mind. When things just, there's this sense of shedding or falling away. So the Four Noble Truths, suffering, the cause of suffering, the cessation of suffering, path leading to the cessation of suffering. This is something ordinary, but it's also really, really important. What's causing the suffering? Well, the cause of suffering is the tanha, the kama tanha, bhava tanha, vibhava tanha, the desire for sensuality, the desire to be, the desire not to be, or the desire for becoming and the desire for not becoming. So that's the cause of suffering. And we learn that right in the beginning. And it seems very straightforward. But then, for myself, it's like keep coming up against it. So there's suffering, and then just that motivation to look. It's hard to actually look and admit it. Oh, wow. Yeah, there's the cause of suffering. There's that desire for it to not be this way. That's why that suffering is there, but it's hard to admit it. It's actually not that difficult to see it, but it's hard to admit it. It's hard to say, oh yeah, there's that desire again. There's that tanha again. And then sometimes we get out of balance. Like there's the, we might see there's the, oh, there's the bhava tanha, the desire to do or to make or become or develop in some way. And it might, and then we might counteract that by saying, okay, we'll cut that off. But then the vibhava tanha gets in there. So there's that sense of, that difficulty of striking a balance. Or it might just be the basic suffering of there wasn't the food I liked, or the person senior to me took the last of the food I do like, and we suffer. And if we don't see that, if we don't see and recognize the tanha, then it can get very heavy and it can fester. That's what the Buddha called, there's these different types of dukkha. So there's like viparinama dukkha, which is the dukkha of change. There's sukha dukkha, which is the dukkha that's inherent in happiness because it's worldly happiness and it's impermanent, it changes. So there's the dukkha that's hidden within sukha, that's sukha dukkha. But then there's dukkha dukkha, which is just that dukkha, which is just dukkha. It's just festering and it's just becoming more and more until we see the cause of it, until we recognize what's going on. This is also a function of that hallowed character, Mara, in the life of the Buddha. So you get the sense Mara is a character that doesn't want us to see this, doesn't want us to see the Four Noble Truths. If anybody likes to look through our old newsletters, there was a column called Letters from Mara, and Metika would do these. And also Ajahn Puddhadhammo, in the very early newsletters, he had these, might have also been called Letters from Mara. We talk about the different armies of Mara. So there's the that temptation or that delusion, which is telling us things that it's kind of been running our life before when we were completely surrendering to and going with the stream of the world. But now that we try to practice, now that we try to go against the stream of the world, then these things become manifest or they rear up and we get to see them. In all the different traditions of Buddhism, they'll teach that when you first start to meditate, it seems like you become more defiled, like more defilements are coming up, but it's totally the case that we're just seeing things which were there. But now that we're going against the stream of the defilements, then we start to see them. We aren't just running along with them. So that's the dukkha that's inherent in the practice. The dukkha leading to the ending of dukkha. That's really what the Buddha's giving us, what the Buddha's gifting to us. He doesn't want us just to be in dukkha dukkha. He wants us to be in the dukkha of the patipat, the patipada, the practice. So there's going to be the suffering that's inherent in that as well because of calling into question the stream of the world, calling into question the defilements, the things that have made us suffer. So So just some things to contemplate as we get going with our winter retreat, and tonight we have the opportunity to practice on the Wanpra, so I don't have so much to say. I'll just leave it there for this evening. So our observance night, we have opportunity to keep practicing, and tea at midnight, morning chanting at 3, and then after that the truck can go up.